Good evening. Tonight, February 12th, 2024, we are opening the Planning and Community Development Committee meeting. My name is Dennis Martinez. I am the chair of the commission. Alongside me is Tosh Sharp, council member, and Armand Papillon, council member. Others in attendance are Marty Wine, administrator, city administrator, Nora Gerloff, DCD director, and Neil Tabor, senior planner for City of Tukwila. Tonight we have a presentation regarding the comprehensive plan status and a little bit of briefing for the 2022 to 2024 goals. With that in mind, go ahead and do your presentation. Yeah.
Great. Thank you, Chair Martinez. So we appreciate everyone taking time tonight. I'm going to jump off the presentation here. And part of this is we wanted to leave plenty of time for discussion afterwards. So we will go through this with the intent to leave time for questions, time for updates, everything to go off of that. Excuse me. Okay. See that? All right. So this is just meant to be kind of an update of where we're at in the comprehensive plan process. So we've been working on this for some time and meant to give a little more background to on kind of the requirements we're held under by the state, regional, and county level and some other aspects of that. So comprehensive plans have a periodic update or kind of a major update that's done every 8 to 10 years under the Growth Management Act or generally the planning framework and state law for the state of Washington. So we're looking at a 20-year time period when we look at the planning period. So even though they're updated about half that time for a major or periodic update, we're looking out 20 years in the future when we make these plans. So we are kind of the first cycle or part of the first cycle in this next major update with all kind of jurisdictions within King, Pierce, Snohomish, and Kitsap County. We have a requirement to adopt an update or major update that complies with all those requirements by December 31st of this year or the end of the year. And every time that they have a new major update, they have new general policy requirements we're required to incorporate into those plans. And this one, the biggest three kind of areas or overarching themes of them would be equity, housing, and climate change. So as mentioned, they have to comply with a lot of different requirements at the state level. So the Department of Commerce kind of oversees a lot of the requirements for planning. So they have their own checklist, their own requirements. Just below that, you have the regional level. For us, it's the Puget Sound Regional Council, which includes the four counties mentioned before, as well as King County has their own requirements within that that kind of build upon or drill down a little bit further onto what those policy requirements are. So we also have within these major updates, they incorporate a lot of the state law changes that have gone on post-2015 when we adopted the last major update of the comprehensive plan. So you can think of a lot of movement in the legislative cycles there that are incorporating some of those aspects into it. They may or may not have periods that have already taken place that it's already required by now. Otherwise, they're incorporating or kind of setting the stage for that. And probably the question naturally arises whenever you have a deadline of what is kind of the impact of not meeting that deadline. So this would make jurisdictions that have not adopted a compliant comprehensive plan by December 31st, 2024 would no longer be eligible generally for federal transportation monies funneled through the regional body or the Puget Sound Regional Council. So oftentimes that means significant amounts of money and grants for federal transportation projects. Which can mean a lot of different things. So at the time, if we theoretically, fingers crossed, we won't have to have that conversation at all, but if we were not to be able to adopt a plan by that date, we would not be eligible and we would become eligible at the time we then adopted a plan after that point. So if it happened into 2025, that's when we would stop or cease not being eligible. A little bit of project schedule. Just a background of kind of the major themes of what we've done to date. I understand this is probably going to be a lot of review for at least one other council member or one council member of the room here, but this started way back in fall 2022, if not before. So That was kind of framing and scoping some of the process, what that would look like. Starting in spring 2023, we really got into or deeper into some community outreach, identifying the major issues for the community, talking with community groups, primarily at that time was about housing options, as we had a middle housing project that was really kind of pushing through and looking at what was happening in the legislature at that point. We have been cycling through Planning Commission reviews of draft elements. So elements are chapters by theme in the plan, look at things like housing, things like transportation, capital facilities, parks, recreation, open space, kind of looking at, again, a comprehensive document. How do we update what we're trying to do as a city in those different themes? What's changed between years, between 2015 and today? What's changed in kind of state law to try to meet with those policy requirements? So all those have been, with the exception of one right now, have been reviewed at least once by the Planning Commission to try to get feedback, to try to see changes, seek input, see if we're missing something, if we need to tweak something, if something's not accurate to the vision of the city, how can we better shape that in their review? So we have had a number of community open houses. One at Showalter Middle School was on September 20th. We've continued kind of targeted community outreach from then. We built a fair number of relationships with the Middle Housing Project that really targeted certain community groups and continued that on throughout the process. We just had another community open house at Tukwila Village at the Sullivan Center on February 1st. So we got some good feedback from residents. We kind of pointed them to an upcoming public hearing at Planning Commission that will take place March 14th. So that will be kind of the first formal step in review of the plan overall. So there'll be a Planning Commission public hearing there that may extend to March 28th, depending on how much we can get through that night. And then we will be transitioning into City Council workshops to look at the comp plan content. So, of course, we spent over a year now going through a Planning Commission as kind of a primer, but we'll have to take some time, of course, with Council as well to make sure they're comfortable, to get feedback there, to integrate those changes, anticipating another open house in May or June of this year, going through the typical environmental review process that's required with it, and eventually this would culminate in a public hearing with the City Council to formally recommend adoption of the plan. So a little bit of mouthful there, but a lot of steps kind of in the process. So we mentioned public outreach. So we've done a good amount of public outreach and just rattled off a few of the different ways we've done so. So various open houses, online engagement hubs, so something that people can come to at all hours of the day to leave feedback, to comment on things, to review what's been produced to date. It has translation features, so it translates at least at a basic level into most any language, and we tried to kind of push that in our promotion, is that that is an option regardless of English proficiency or if just someone's more comfortable reading in another language. So contracting with key community groups, as mentioned, that was a big part of our middle housing project. We worked with the Black Home Ownership Initiative, as well as a couple other groups. Somali Health Board gave really good feedback on what is important to those communities, capitalized on some outreach that already been done as part of the economic development and other plans as well. And we're constantly tabling, looking at different places, different aspects of the community, trying to be available in multiple ways, as well as doing some stakeholder interviews for key stakeholders in the community who have kind of a more knowledge of the communities they represent or otherwise to give feedback into the plan. And just a few pictures during a few events we did. So I know we kind of gave a brief timeline, but speaking about a little bit more of the process kind of going forward, the Planning Commission review of individual elements is down to its final one, which will be in the next meeting a week from Thursday. So we'll be reviewing the transportation element, cleaning up a few changes from other elements suggested. Again, aforementioned public hearing on March 14th at the Planning Commission. So each planning or periodic update of the comp plan has to go through a basic environmental review, as mentioned. So we want to make sure that we have something that's largely similar to what we're going to be pushing forward and working with council on. So that review would likely come shortly after that Planning Commission stage in the process. We also have preliminary review with those three bodies mentioned before of King County, PSRC, or Puget Sound Regional Council, the state or Department of Commerce, to get, see if we're on track with their own requirements. So even if we all agree as a city that this is the comp plan we want to see, if it does not meet or check the boxes for their requirements, it won't comply or won't actually meet the requirement for adoption. So that would go forward in the council review, an eventual public hearing before the council, adoption of the comprehensive plan, and then certification or review and approval by those bodies. So I think I mentioned the public hearing there. We have draft elements and document reports that will be further refined in the next few months. We do have the draft elements available for public review online, so we're still taking comments and feedback on those. And I think we mentioned council review, but this will be kind of the primer for many more conversations that come on the draft elements in this state and where we're at now. I realize I talked quite a bit there, and I just want to open it up for questions, discussion, and happy to jump back and forth if anything, presentation or otherwise.
If nobody has a couple questions, I have a couple right off the top. When does DCD plan to present the draft to council? Because you said that there's a couple of other steps, and we know we're going to do the outreach in March, April, June, or whatever, because it has to be adopted by December 31st. So when's the projected final draft to council for council approval?
I think that would depend on kind of some of the steps in between now. So we don't anticipate just giving you a whole draft in a forum and saying, what do you think? I think we want to chunk out a little bit more to say, here's these four elements or these two or three elements that are substantially similar and complementary to each other. What do we think? Do we want to get a little more in the weeds in a work session or other format to that rather than just passing off what has been kind of the working draft with the Planning Commission? So I can't give you a firm date with that. I think probably later into summer, fall for the actual final full.
Nancy, have you worked with Laurel at all to get that schedule together?
Yes, we will be meeting with Laurel council staff to work out the schedule. Our intent is to look at whether we can, if there's what the best approach is for this, potentially to take a couple of hearings on different sort of clumps of the various comp plan elements and then move forward that way. Ideally, we will be completed by September or October so that the council will have time to focus on the budget. As Neil mentioned, it does need to be completed by the end of the year, but we're going to work with Laurel to figure out what your workload is and when the times are for conducting both the sort of the foundational review as well as the hearings and that type of thing.
Okay, thank you. And the reason I asked is because I know a little bit about the planning part of it, and I know that it's been going on for a long time, and more so it's to let the other members of the committee know what that there is, it's been a long process. The other question I have, and it's related to, we talked about this comp plan is going to be for 2024 to 2044, so it's a 20-year plan. Will any of the legislative bills that are passed, let's say next year, because this is a short session, next year and thereafter through 2024, will they be adopted into the finalized plan, or will anything that happens in between that 20-year span, will that not be adopted until the expiration of the comp plan?
Yeah, so we have kind of the major, the periodic update that happens every 8 to 10 years generally. Then we have restrictions or kind of criteria for doing annual updates, so you can only amend your comp plan once a year. So if there was something to say passed in the 2025, I guess not cycle, but the first year of the 2025-2026 legislative cycle, we could amend that in our comprehensive plan that year when we do the annual update. We, of course, can't, no crystal ball, can't predict the future on what will pass in the future, but we are staging for things like middle housing, like the ADU bill that passed, objective design review, some of those other things that we know have passed, even if they aren't effective until mid-2025, those are being incorporated into this update or this periodic update.
Okay, good. So the answer is basically you could change it once a year, and then every periodic 8 years, there's a process that you can modify it as well.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, thank you. That's all the questions I had.
You said the periodic updates are every 8 years?
About 8 to 10. So okay. It's set at the regional level. So the four counties, King, Snohomish, Pierce, and Kitsap are all on the deadline of end of 2024 cycle, whereas I believe the next one, you have Thurston and Fallon maybe, and a few others would be the next. So it's kind of on a rolling cycle set by the regional body. So I think they've made an effort to align some of those dates together for different things so that more of the high-level planning things happen or have deadlines at the same time. But that's when we would generally expect the next one to be 8 to 10 years.
But we can make amendments. I mean, are we allowed to make amendments to the comprehensive plan? Or is it every 8 years?
Yeah.
Or could it be every year?
Every year you can make amendments. Okay. This is generally thought of as the bigger overhaul of amendments or the more major ones. So you'll have new policies that you have to meet with it. A lot of things rolled into it compared to you might be refining the edges or just looking for consistency. In years between, there's often a lot of resources in terms of grants and other things that go on to support the major or the periodic updates.
Right. So we're in the like top to bottom, look at everything, get new direction, whereas the annual ones tend to be more like Tukwila wants to tweak a zone or wants to address a more local issue. And so we have that opportunity to do that.
This presentation is really high level. Well, thank you for that. So I don't really have too many questions. I think as we get more information and more information gets settled down, that's when I'll have comments and thoughts to provide. In terms of all the community events that have been taking place, the open houses, I know we've been providing, at least I believe at the last one, there's translation services, right?
Mm-hmm.
Were any of the translation services used or utilized?
I think we've had a little bit in Spanish and Somali used, not as much as we'd hope to, of course. It's one thing to have it available, it's another to...
Right.
You know, make sure the community knows that it's there for them and have the option to do so. We've had some more success working with like Somali Health Board and those that already have the ins in the community and already have great relationships to build off and show how, you know, their voice can be heard in the process. But it's definitely been, a challenge throughout the process that we've been trying to get better at as we go.
The reason I asked that question is because I've been asked a lot, why doesn't the city provide translation services? And I did see translation services at the last one, but I didn't see anyone utilizing these translation services. Mm-hmm. So I think that's problematic. And not for the city, but we are using, you know, city dollars to fund translation services, and it's a big expense. And it would be fine if those services were being utilized, but I think that's just part of the planning process, which I think really stood out to me, is because so many community members make those comments, but then when those services are being provided, they're not being utilized. And it's a little bit unfortunate. And then in terms of, so I know you said one of the most significant periodic updates in this cycle is equity. What does that necessarily mean holistically for Tukwila?
Well, I think it tackles a number of different areas. I think some of the first few you think about would be housing and environmental impacts to that. So King County especially has a lot of pretty specific and pretty in-depth requirements for equity. So looking at communities that have been historically disenfranchised, either through housing discrimination, generalized discrimination, and environmental justice issues and otherwise. So looking at the concept that race-neutral policies don't produce race-neutral impacts when you have, you know, societal racism or as landmark kind of things based upon, you know, decades of historic racism.
Mm-hmm.
So looking at how you can do corrective actions in that way, whether in housing, whether in other places. So that was some of the focus of the Middle Housing Grant project we had previously, as looking at what is kind of the development history of being sited without sewer service or having development that's next to kind of nuisance uses that might have or being redlined perhaps, that has, you know, restrained housing, increase in housing values and, you know, generational wealth that could be derived from those, or people from ownership that translates into generational wealth. So a lot of policies have specifics for thinking about, as you apply this policy, how are you going to make sure that you're being equitable in how it's applied? How are you looking at how you've been corrected and that action of how that's applied? So that's layered into a lot of the policy requirements and include language and think about how you're going to look at BIPOC communities, for instance, and how a lot of the, you know, way your city has developed out or land use patterns may or not be based on historical discrimination in that field. So how can you correct it? How can you provide more home ownership opportunities? How could you combine that with something like 1474, the Home Ownership Covenant Act that was passed last year, to have more people franchise have opportunities by the market? So a lot of policies that get into specifically, but that hopefully that's a little bit of an overview of that.
Yeah, so I guess then sort of equity then falls into more of like the housing and the climate areas, right? And then there's probably a bit more that equity is not touching on, because you could think of like healthcare as like part of equity, and how Black, Indigenous, and basically BIPOC communities have been impacted or disenfranchised in terms of being provided good health here in Tekoa. And you mentioned redlining. Does Tekoa actually have a history of any redlining?
Tekoa does not have a history of redlining that we could find. Generally, it's major cities. So you can see Seattle's redlining map, Tacoma's, Spokane, pretty. We did look at racially restrictive covenants. So one of the other ways that more discreetly you can see if there is effectively formalized ways of not allowing people of certain races to buy in. So we did find some properties, I think four examples of racially restrictive covenants that are in what is modern day Tekoa. So, and if I need to find that a little more, Ken?
McKinn. It's not the whole city, but there were some plats that did have those.
What did those covenants look like or state that it restricts from other people from buying housing in that area?
No person of this race shall be sold this property or shall live on this premises. They were very bold.
And that was in Tekoa's policies, or that was when those areas of Tekoa got annexed, or is sort of
the subdivider would write that into the private subdivision.
I just put subdivider.
Who so like Bill Boeing owned a bunch of property in Shoreline and did a lot of land division and would take a big estate and carve it up into building lots.
Right.
And very famous that his were very restrictive.
Real.
And on a smaller scale, you see some of that across the region, but even a few here in Tekoa.
Yeah, so the University of Washington has a racially restrictive covenants project. You can look and actually see what the language was at the time, the areas that it affected kind of across the state now.
And of course, they're unenforceable, but a lot of times they remain on the title until someone takes action to enforce them.
Also, my question,
the only question I have really is, it states on page 2, the university policies were updated, and that on occasion there's a non-agreement between the planning commission and the administration. It states that you'll highlight those, but what's a ballpark idea that those two entities didn't agree on that you can think?
Yeah, I think there's two policies that I think we've directly come to in land use around. One was around preservation and redevelopment of affordable housing. So if you have areas that are currently in the market, they rent at below what you would expect or at levels that are generally in some level of affordability expect. We want to look at that as a resource. And if it can be preserved and still be good housing, we want to try and strive to retain that for the people who earn at levels so they can affordably live in those units. Or if we're going to redevelop, try to create set aside so we can still have people remain in the community if their property is redeveloped, or just generally have that affordability built into it. That was one.
Let me ask you, based on that one policy, what was the discrepancy there? What was the hang up between the two entities?
So I believe Planning Commission voted 3-3 on that one. It wasn't so much a discrepancy between staff and planning commission, but I believe they were 3-3 of whether they wanted to retain it or not.
We had lost our seventh member, so we didn't have a tiebreaker on it.
In the event of tiebreakers or things like that, how does it default?
I think ultimately we would just kind of present it as is, as this was something that was a 3-3 tiebreak. Ultimately, council is going to be the body, you know, voting to adopt this so they could make changes. Ultimately, the PC recommendation is just that. It's a recommendation based on their review, their suggestions, changes that have been integrated to that.
Okay. And then what I'm gathering is that there's a consensus between staff, administration, and the planning commission. If there's no highlight to bring to council, or does the council still weigh in on those decisions, all of those numerous decisions that you guys go through?
Yeah, so the intent was to kind of refine it to this stage through planning commission. So it's been looked at. We've had kind of the initial staff pass at it. We've had refinements for just basic things like this is a little more readable. This is a better way to organize this. This is better grammar even. This is a typo, as I made plenty of within my draft. So they've made all those recommendations, as well as if they had disagreement on content and there was a place where we felt like, PC Planning Commission wanted to go one direction and seemed like it still carried the body of it or the, you know, intent of the policy and it still met the regional requirement. If there was something underlying that, we've just integrated that change throughout the cycle. I don't think we can create a copy that has, you know, 10 iterations of red lines in it, but you'll see the full body of this is the element and this is, you know, the policies within that we came to. And again, if there are those odd few where Planning Commission was split, or staff felt, let's say, that we weren't meeting the regional policy requirement by doing so, we will highlight that with it. But I think they're pretty few and far between at this point in the process.
Okay. And I guess what I'm asking is, if there's consensus, it's just in the document without the highlighting. Is that right?
Yeah, correct.
Okay. Thank you.
No more questions? Any questions from administration?
So, Ed, can I ask?
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. No.
I know we had conversations about, how do large projects fit into Tukwila. So, we had conversations about, you know, future of Tukwila, like 10, 15 years from now, when we're much older. And potentially redeveloping ourselves in our district, and where we could see tens of more thousands of residents living in that area. How would large projects like a sound transit project to that area, what would it look like in a comprehensive plan? Would a project like that, which would be really open in the air and maybe not even realistic, would it be even included in something like a comprehensive plan, or would it be vague and say something, we would like to see more robust transportation in this region? But I'm curious to know, especially projects like that aren't necessarily completely in control of city of, are not really in control by the city of Tukwila, but by other government agencies. How do they fall into the comprehensive plan?
Well, one example might be the Boeing Access Road light rail station, mm-hmm. which was deferred. So it's been in our comprehensive plan as something we want and, you know, I want to continue to work with Sound Transit to develop. It looks like now it's finally coming to pass. So we've had it in there as a desired future outcome.
Right.
And that means that when they actually do come in and start designing it, you can say, yes, this matches our comp plan. You're good to go.
Mm-hmm.
Other things are more general, like we would like more housing at South Center. And so there's policies around encouraging housing and what do we want it to look like and wanting to serve a variety of different populations and things. So then, you know, we have private companies come in with a specific development proposal. And again, we say, yes, that matches our comp plan or that matches our comp plan, but we also really want pedestrian features or something like that we can say, like, this would really push it to the next level and meet multiple goals at the same time.
Got it. And then what if it's a project like the Sigali development, which from what I know is going to expire within, I believe, this year, something like that? And it's a really large project, right? It could even affect city financing, both positive, negative. But a project like that, would that be included in a comprehensive plan? Or?
So it's a sub-area, so it's discussed, and there are specific goals and policies around what we'd like to see in that sub-area. The development agreement is kind of another layer, even if the development agreement changed or expired, we would still have policies about what we'd like to see there in any case. It would just, the regulations might be slightly different, or we might need to rework the regulations, but it's not like we're saying we don't want anything to happen. It's just that there was a specific vision that was kind of time limited, but we want to work towards a good outcome for that area. Right? Mm-hmm. And so I think the vision is the same, even if the zoning changes from time to time.
Got it. That is very helpful.
So a little bit more on that, and on the urban development of the South Center area. Last year, council with a presentation by Department of DCD, the council approved some incentives for developers to develop in that, in the South Center area. And that's, and that happens quite, that happens because they see the need, or we see the need to have that. So again, some things we don't see today, but were past, in the past years. And then vision for the, for the future, example is that pedestrian bridge over here. That is a bridge that a lot of people didn't think it would be used, but it actually now with the new development of the Sounders administration facility over there, there's going to be a lot of people that are going to be, traveling back and forth for the World Cup.
Mm-hmm.
So the little things that, that happen that take long-term range planning, eventually things start to fit in, all the puzzle pieces start to fit in.
And then on a completely different topic, I know Tukul has a really large housing stock that's affordable, and yet I believe by the state we're required to build even more affordable housing, which is fine. We want affordable housing. But does that basically require us to build even, does any of the state legislation take into consideration that some cities already have a lot of affordable housing and how that impacts, I'm not too familiar with some organizations like SHAG or the nonprofit sector that are building housing. I'm not sure if they become taxpayers or not, and how burdensome it is for the city to continue on building those housing, because you still have to upkeep right roads and parks and everything else. But does it require us to build even more housing?
There was much discussion at the regional level about that. So there was a lot of, so we have a housing target overall, and then new in this planning cycle is targets of affordability within that. So all the way from market rate to below 30%. And so there was a lot of discussion, as you can imagine, about which area should have, where that curve should be. And I think they came up with a pretty good kind of hybrid solution. One thing was, we're only going to look at, we're going to draw a line in the sand and only look at units completed after this date. And the other one was, we should really, we should get total credit. If we've already met our one, we don't have to build any more affordable housing. And so they kind of came up with one in the middle. And so Tukulis is kind of interesting. It's kind of a U. So we're saying we actually need a lot of market rate housing because we don't have as much as we would like, but everybody needs the 0 to 30% because the market doesn't provide that and it's so hard to develop. So, but in the middle, we actually have a fair amount of, 80% to AMI kind of, some of which housing is at risk, but we do have that housing stock here. So each curve is different for each city. But I think they came up with a pretty fair allocation of that.
Thank you. That's all the questions I had.
And I have one more.
Yeah.
So as far as a developer coming into Tukwila building, they're tasked with making affordable housing. And how does the city balance whether or not it's profitable for that developer to do that work or to sell that piece of property or development at whatever rate the state determines is fair or at that market rate. How does the city compensate that individual or make provide incentives for them to do that deal? Is there any?
And of course, we can't dictate. The housing goals are aspirational. We need to provide the framework for people to come in, the right amount of zoned land, incentives to do affordability, but we can't tell any given developer, your project has to be so much. But we can say, if you want the multifamily tax exemption, you need to have this many units available at this affordability for this many years. They can choose not to take advantage of that incentive.
How often does the city of Tukwila encounter that situation where a developer says, look, I can develop this land for X amount. What you're asking for doesn't balance out as far as the numbers. Does that ever happen?
Everything we have is incentive-based, so they can choose. We have heard from a lot of developers that they feel like the multifamily tax exemption, it should just be a standard. And economic development last year worked at putting that back into place as a targeted incentive. So the city can decide. You know, we waive some permit fees for affordable housing based on what level of affordability there is. So we try and be a welcoming environment for it, but we can't dictate.
No one's saying that you're dictating. Mm-hmm. You're providing parameters that they have to build with it. My mm-hmm. question is, has a developer ever come to Tukwila and said, hey, look, what you're offering, I can't make the dollars meet match. Mm-hmm. Has that ever happened?
Well,
or is everyone happy when they come to Tukwila and they're like, yeah, that's perfect?
Sometimes they say, I want more height. And so like the Airmark Apartments was a pioneer development here. And so they were kind of proving the concept of housing in the urban center and said, we want to go higher than your code allows. And we said, well, we feel like there's a public benefit. So we did a development agreement to change the zoning standards for them. So that was another type of incentive.
So there is enough latitude within the rules for you to accommodate folks to get the deal done?
We try and do it, like with JAG or with Homestead, the project at Riverton Park United Methodist Church. Yeah. Affordable home ownership was a great goal, and we worked with them to make that happen.
Thanks.
Mm-hmm.
No other questions.
Okay.